We had a party of 11 on the boat, and we were anticipating a fine day's outing. We wanted to hear the music on the way up the river, and so all of us were gathered on the after deck, not more than 20 feet away from the band and close to the rail of the deck. The first intimation we had that there was something wrong was when a scream came from the forward part of the boat. We concluded that someone must have fallen overboard and began scanning the water in the wake of the boat. We did not have to wait too long, though, to find out what the real trouble was. A few seconds after the first scream, there was a general panic on the forward deck. We could hear the women and children screaming, and in an instant later, there was a puff of smoke and flame near the bow of the boat. I realized then that we were all in the gravest of peril, and that if we expected to escape with our lives, some of us at least must keep our cool heads. In our party were my daughter, Annette, my son-in-law and daughter, Mr. and Mrs. Henry Schnood, and their two children, my daughter, Mrs. Frieda Tawnyport, and her two children. In addition to these nine, there were the father and mother of Mr. Schnood. The moment I saw the flames, I called all of our party together and told them quietly that if we were to escape alive, we must stick close together so as to be able to help one another. I thought the strongest among us could take care of the weak, but my words of warning were not more out of my mouth when there came a rush of panic-stricken people to the stern of the boat that no human being could have stood against. I clung to the rail and managed to hold my place, but when I looked around, not one member of my family was to be seen anywhere. They had been whisked away from me in the rush. I did not know what had been their fate. By that time, there were scores of women and children in the water. At last, I managed to get a foot upon the rail by clinging with my hands to a post. From that point of vantage, I watched the crowd in search of my loved ones, but they were nowhere to be seen. Just then, I saw our pastor, Mr. Reverend Haas, and his wife and daughter at the other side of the boat. He was trying to protect them from the trampling crowd. Then a minute later, I saw them climb over the rail and all jump into the river. I took another careful look around to see if any of my family were on the boat. Still, they were nowhere to be seen. Then I decided to take my chances in the water. The fire was so near. My hands and face were scorched and blistered. There were holes in my clothing that had been burned there by the flying sparks. I climbed over the rail and jumped feet first into the water. It seemed to me I sank hundreds of feet and I should never come to the surface again. But at last I saw a flash of light, and that told me I was up where I could get a breath of air. I tried to keep myself from sinking again by striking out blindly with my hands and feet, and did manage to keep up for a few seconds. In that brief time, I saw women and children around me in the water. They all seemed to be drowning. I remember I wondered in a dreamy sort of way if any of my children were near me and if they would be rescued. Then my strength failed and I sank once more. I stopped struggling and didn't seem to care any longer whether I ever rose up to the top or not. Just then my head struck against something hard. That aroused my senses and I grabbed at whatever had bumped my head. I caught it with my hands and I held on. Once I got a breath of air, my strength came back a little, and I discovered I was clinging to the paddle box. I held on desperately, and a minute or two later, a man in a small rowboat pulled up close to me. The boatman held out an oar, yelled to me to grasp it and hold fast. I did so, and he soon hauled me aboard his boat. I begged him, "Look for the other members of my family," but as he had as many in his boat as it would hold, he had to go ashore.
These are the words of 52-year-old Mrs. Catherine Casabon, a survivor of the raging fire and subsequent sinking of the paddle wheel steamship General Slocum on June 15, 1904. The catastrophic demise of the ship rocked New York City. Families were torn apart, and a community disappeared from the map. Flames of Sorrow, The General Slocum Tragedy, today on Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs, tales of mishaps, misfortune, and misadventure. I'm your host, Rich Napolitano. The sinking of the paddle-wheel steamship General Slocum in 1904 was one of the worst maritime tragedies in American history. But its story has largely been overshadowed by other events, such as the San Francisco Fire in 1906, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire in 1911, and the sinking of the Titanic in 1912. The massive loss of life from the General Slocum disaster was shocking to the citizens of New York City. It's my hope that, even if in a very small fashion, this episode helps preserve the memory of this tragedy and of those who were lost. The hull of the paddle-wheel steamship General Slocum was laid down in 1890 and built by Divine Burtis Jr. of Brooklyn, New York. The remaining upper structures of the vessel were built by John E. Hoffmeyer & Son of New York. She was 264 feet long, 37.5 feet wide, 1,284 gross tons, and its engine was built by W.N.A. Fletcher Company of Hoboken, New Jersey. The oak and pine vessel was powered by two side paddle wheels, each 31 feet in diameter, with 26 paddles each. The ship was named in honor of Civil War General Henry Warner Slocum, who later became a U.S. congressman. Slocum served as the senior field general under General George Meade during the Battle of Gettysburg and successfully defended Culp's Hill from Confederate attacks. Built as an excursion ship for the Knickerbocker Steamboat Company, the General Slocum featured three decks, which extended down its entire length, giving passengers ample space to meander around the decks. Two open-air saloons offered fantastic views of the city and fresh air. It was a large, roomy vessel, designed to carry 2,500 passengers, with all cabins below deck. Her three watertight compartments were a new safety feature for that time period. Painted a brilliant white with yellow funnels, she was hailed as a beautiful, modern ship at the time of its maiden voyage on June 25, 1891. The General Slocum's usual route was from Manhattan to Rockaway from May through October at a cost of 50 cents. The five-hour trip was popular with the wealthy city dwellers and allowed them to escape the stress and congestion of Manhattan for a while. In command of the General Slocum was a veteran seaman, Captain William H. Van Schaik, who was one of the most trusted captains employed by Knickerbocker. However, after just 4 months into her service, she ran aground at Rockaway Inlet and had to be pulled free by tugboats. 1894 proved to be even more challenging. She struck a sandbar with 4,700 passengers on board. The force of the collision was so great that it knocked out the ship's generator. A month later, she ran aground off Coney Island during a storm, and all its passengers had to be put aboard another ship. In September, the ship collided with the tug R.T. Sayre in the East River, causing major damage to the ship's steering. Later in 1898, she struck the vessel Amelia near Battery Park, and in 1901, experienced a near mutiny with 900 intoxicated anarchists from Paterson, New Jersey, on board. The rowdy bunch started a riot and attempted to take control of the ship, but the crew was able to fight them off. The ship was docked at the pier belonging to the police, and 17 of the men on board were arrested. A year later, she once again ran aground, and 400 passengers on board were left stranded overnight on the helpless ship. By 1904, the General Slocum was showing its age. It no longer awed its passengers with its beauty and speed. The newer, faster, and more luxurious ships were now drawing the wealthy crowd. However, the General Slocum continued its regular service to Rockaway, catering mostly to the middle and lower classes. Along with its sister ship, the Grand Republic, they were still the largest excursion ships serving the New York area at this time. For 17 straight years, St. Mark's Evangelical Lutheran Church held an excursion for its parishioners, in celebration for the end of the Sunday school year. St. Mark's was the heart of the Lower East Side section of Manhattan called Little Germany. Essentially, all of St. Mark's parishioners were German immigrants or of German heritage. Pastor George Haas planned the church's 1904 excursion for June 15, 1904, and chartered the General Slocum at a cost of $350 for the day. Church parishioners would be transported from Manhattan up the East River into Long Island Sound, and then to Locust Grove on Long Island, where the annual picnic would take place. At 7 a.m., the General Slocum departed the 50th Street Pier, where she was docked overnight, and arrived at the 3rd Street Pier at 8 o'clock a.m. Anxious parishioners were gathered at the pier. Women dressed for the occasion according to the style at the time, generally long, heavy, flowing dresses, gloves, and fashionable hats. Children were also dressed in their Sunday best. This was a Wednesday, and most of the men of the parish were working. The vast majority of those in attendance were Sunday school teachers, mothers, and their children. Departure was planned for 8 o'clock a.m., and the parishioners quickly boarded the ship. After an unexpected delay, the General Slocum departed the 3rd Street Pier on the Lower East Side of Manhattan at 9:30 a.m. She was under the guidance of pilots Edward Von Wart and Edwin Weaver, and Captain Von Schaik entered the pilot house just a short time after departing. The New York Times reported, "As she cast off and stood out into the stream, her flags were flying, the band was playing a lively air, and her 3 decks were crowded to their capacity with a happy throng that looked for a pleasant day's outing." On board were 1,358 passengers, along with 30 crew and officers. All was well as the ship pulled away. The exuberant passengers lined the railings of all 3 decks, waving, shouting, and laughing. For many of them, this excursion was their only chance at a small slice of luxury. The General Slocum's onboard band played German favorites, much to the delight of the crowd. At 10 o'clock a.m., the ship passed through the narrow section of the East River called Hellgate. As passengers enjoyed the food and drink, they and most of the crew were unaware that a small fire had broken out in the forward cabin under the main deck, toward the bow. This room, roughly 30 square feet, was used as a storage room and housed barrels of lamp oil and empty lamps needing refilling. Also stored here were drinking glasses packed in straw, engine oil, mineral oil, various cans of paint and lacquer, spare lumber, charcoal, canvas, stools, and other assorted items. A few of the crewmen and passengers noticed puffs of smoke coming up from the hatch going down to the forward cabin. When the crew opened the hatch to investigate, the sudden influx of oxygen provided the fire with fuel to burn. In a panic, one crewman attempted to smother the fire with 2 sacks of nearby charcoal. Mate Edward Flanagan immediately informed the pilot house using the speaking tube, while the others attempted unsuccessfully to smother the fire. The men then rushed to retrieve the fire hose, but the thin linen hose was kinked and in poor condition, and burst into pieces when the water pressure was engaged. Knickerbocker had installed these low-quality and inexpensive hoses in 1891, and failed to replace them over the ship's 13 years of service. With the main fire hose destroyed, a rubber fire hose was retrieved, but the crew could not manage to attach it. After just a short time, the men were forced to give up and evacuate the room. Some jumped overboard, while others ran to the rear of the ship. According to surviving witnesses, only a handful of crewmen passed out life preservers to passengers. The vast majority only tried to save themselves. The crew were grossly unprepared for a fire emergency, as only the captain and chief engineer had ever been trained in fire safety or participated in a fire drill. Passengers and crew above deck smelled the smoke and figured it must have come from the ship's kitchen. "Don't mind that, it's the chowder cooking," one passenger joked. Thinking nothing of it, they continued on with their festivities, unaware of the pending danger. 12-year-old Frank Prodzicki was one of the first to see the smoke coming from below deck. He ran to the pilot house to tell the captain, but Van Schaik screamed at the boy, "Get the hell out of here." Spectators on shore waved frantically at the ship, trying to call attention to the smoke pouring out of the ship's portholes. When the fire alert was heard in the pilot house by Captain Von Schaik, the ship was east of Ward's Island, just north of where the Robert F. Kennedy Bridge is located today. The captain ordered full speed ahead and to stay on course, and then left the pilot house for a short time. When he returned, he ordered Van Wart to beach the ship on North Brother Island, just a short distance ahead, and the captain then positioned himself on the hurricane deck. The fire quickly burned upward through the main deck, promenade deck, and hurricane deck, engulfing the pilot house. Pastor George Haas described the scene, as he was enjoying the morning with his wife and daughter when the fire began. "The band was playing and the women and the children were crowded around the musicians listening to the piece. Then came the cry of fire and the awful scene. In 3 minutes, it could not have been more, all three decks were ablaze. Passengers tumbled down to the lower decks as the promenade and hurricane decks came crashing down on the helpless people below. Some jumped overboard to take their chances in the East River rather than remain on the floating inferno. A mass of screaming and panicked people scrambled to get off the ship. In the chaos, men pushed, shoved, and even trampled women and children, desperately trying to escape the ship. 6 metal lifeboats were on board the General Slocum, as well as 2 life rafts. Crew and passengers alike attempted to launch them, but the boats were fastened to the ship with strong wire, and much of the wire had been painted over several times. Due to their inaccessibility, none of the lifeboats or life rafts were ever launched. Some passengers managed to find life preservers, and surprisingly, the General Slocum actually did carry enough for everyone. But unfortunately, these were the original life preservers placed on board in 1891, and like the fire hoses, they were in poor condition. Manufactured under the brand name Kahnweiler's Never Sink Life Preservers, they were rotten and torn, and many of them crumbled into dust when handled. The granulated cork inside had deteriorated so badly that they absorbed water rather than provide buoyancy. Unaware of the futility of the life preservers, children were thrown into the water wearing the life belts, and parents watched in horror as they disappeared under the surface. Survivor John Kircher described how his wife put a life preserver on their daughter and tossed her into the river, lamenting. But the child never appeared. She had sunk as though a stone were tied to her. As the blazing ship pushed on, the fire was fanned toward the stern of the ship, spreading quickly through the decks. Over the years, her wooden decks and railings had been coated with many layers of highly flammable paint and varnish, adding to the intensity of the flames. The horror-stricken crowd moved to the rear of the ship as quickly as possible, trying to stay ahead of the advancing fire. Those who were pushed aside or trampled were unable to save themselves and were consumed by the fire. Survivor Anna Weber recalled the chaos. "Get life preservers," said a man, "and we all stood up on camp stools and on the benches and reached for life preservers. Some of them we could not budge, and the others pulled to pieces and spilled the crumbs of cork over our heads. The heat was blistering, and the flames swept along the roof of the deck and scorched our fingers as we tried to snatch down the life preservers. The flames drove those who were standing around me back and over to the side of the boat." The General Slocum continued to speed toward North Brother Island, engulfed in flames, with black smoke billowing into the air. In her wake, the East River was scattered with debris, torn life preservers, and people, both living and dead.
Hey everyone, Rich here. As much as I love telling you about maritime history, I also listen to a lot of podcasts, and I want to tell you about one that I personally love, American Elections: Wicked Game. There have been some wild elections in American history that broke all the rules of civility. There have been elections decided behind closed doors, elections that resulted in murder. And when you learn all this, and that we endured vicious, vile political contests over and over, you might come away feeling a little better about what's to come in 2024. From the host of American History Tellers, American Elections Wicked Game explores the entire history of presidential elections, from the unanimous and inevitable election of George Washington in 1789 to Donald Trump's surprise electoral victory in 2016 and his contested defeat in 2020. Follow American Elections Wicked Game wherever you're listening now, or to get early ad-free access to the entire series, bingeable now, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe to Into History at intohistory.com.
Finally, at 10:20 a.m., the ship ran aground on the southern shore of North Brother Island. As the ship approached, Captain von Schaik leapt from the hurricane deck into the shallow water below and scrambled ashore, losing an eye in the process. The ship's bow came to rest about 10 feet from shore in 7 feet of water, allowing the two pilots to easily escape the pilot house into the shallow water. While several hundred had already jumped off the flaming ship, the majority of passengers remained trapped at the stern, which protruded about 60 feet from shore and in much deeper water. The scene at North Brother Island was utter carnage. Mothers frantically screamed for their children. Children wailed for their mothers. At this time in the United States, many citizens could not swim, and the large, heavy dresses worn by the women made it even more difficult to stay afloat. It was a heart-wrenching tragedy unfolding before the eyes of nearby onlookers. Within minutes, the screaming stopped, and the dead littered the water. Between 400 and 600 people were drowned or consumed by fire after the ship was beached on North Brother Island. A number of nearby boats quickly arrived, including the tugs John L. Wade and Walter Tracy. These vessels rescued a few hundred people from the water and provided assistance. North Brother Island happened to be the location of a quarantine hospital, and its nurses and other staff rushed to the scene to provide care for those on shore. Additional doctors, nurses, and chaplains were ferried to the island, along with undertakers, to begin processing the dead. Fireboats soon pulled alongside the General Slocum and sprayed the flaming hulk, which reduced the fire somewhat, but did not extinguish it. In just 15 minutes, the ship had burned to the waterline. For 90 more minutes, the ship was sprayed down, until finally, it floated off a mile to the northeast, listed to port, and sank. The once majestic steamship was now lying on its port side, stuck in the mud, with only the pathetic remnants of the smokestack and the starboard paddle wheel visible above the water. For several days, bodies continued to be recovered as they washed ashore on North Brother Island, the Bronx, and Manhattan. A temporary morgue was set up in a warehouse on the East 26th Street dock, where distraught families could try to find their loved ones. The impact on the neighborhood of Little Germany was devastating. In the days and weeks following the disaster, funerals were held all over the city. On June 18th alone, a funeral procession of 156 victims and glass-enclosed hearses were led through the streets by horses adorned in all black. It proceeded across the Williamsburg Bridge spanning the East River to Middle Village in Queens, where they were laid to rest at All Faiths Lutheran Cemetery. Many more were buried in Brooklyn at Cemetery of the Evergreens and Greenwood Cemetery. The neighborhood of Little Germany had been in decline for many years, and it essentially ceased to exist following the General Slocum disaster. Whole families were wiped out, and almost everyone suffered the loss of a friend or family member. Many of the residents left Little Germany, moving uptown or to Queens to be near their lost loved ones. Of the 1,388 on board, a total of 1,021 people lost their lives in the East River. 90%, or over 900 of those lost, were women and children. All but two of the 30 crew survived. The death toll was staggering and shocking to a grieving public who demanded answers. On June 28, 1904, a federal investigation commission was authorized by Secretary of Commerce and Labor, George B. Cortelyou, to thoroughly investigate all matters pertaining to the cause of the General Slocum disaster. Assistant Secretary of Commerce and Labor Herbert Knox Smith was appointed as the commission's presiding officer. Throughout July, August, and September of 1904, the commission interviewed witnesses, survivors, and crew. The commission sought to answer two questions. When was the fire first discovered, and when was the captain made aware of the fire? Captain von Schaik and the two pilots all testified that they were made aware of the fire when the ship was near Sunken Meadow, upriver from Hellgate, which would be several minutes difference in travel time. But many of the witnesses who were on the main deck testified with specific details of passing Hellgate when they first saw smoke from the fire. Testimony from witnesses who were on shore corroborated the evidence from the passengers on the main deck. Ultimately, the testimony from the captain and pilots was found to be unreliable, as the three of them would be less culpable if the fire began several minutes later. The commission also established that Mate Edward Flanagan notified the pilot house using the speaking tube immediately before he attempted to fight the fire. The report states, "If the testimony of the men in the pilot house were correct, it would be necessary to assume that only from 3 to 3.5 minutes elapsed from the first coming up of the flames at the forward cabin stairway until the time at North Brother Island when the fire was raging fiercely over half the vessel." Specifically, Captain von Schaik was accused of neglect to fight fire or aid passengers, or to give any orders to such end, and neglect to beach the vessel or to put her alongside of a wharf immediately after receiving a report of the existence of the fire, and his action in maintaining a high speed and creating thereby a strong draft of air from forward, sweeping the flames aft. When the captain was asked why he didn't beach the ship sooner, von Scheik claimed he attempted to beach near the 130th Street Pier, but a tugboat captain told him to stay away due to stores of lumber and barrels of oil nearby. Among the public, there was speculation that the captain didn't beach the ship for insurance reasons. But it wasn't just Captain von Scheik who received blame. The commission also found fault with the crew, stating, "Marked inefficiency of the crew, both in this case and probably in most other excursion vessels, principally due to lack of organization and drill, and a total lack of fire drills, boat drills, and established discipline." Very few surviving passengers testified to receiving any assistance from crew members, as most of them jumped overboard to save themselves. Furthermore, it was discovered that Mate Edward Flanagan was unlicensed and therefore was illegally on board the General Slocum and unqualified to serve in that capacity. The report goes on to describe the poor condition of fire safety equipment. The fire hose was probably of the cheapest grade, merely linen, priced less than 10 cents a foot, and several years old. The only fire buckets on the main deck were out of reach, had no water in them, nor was it customary to keep water in these buckets. During the investigation, a significant discovery was made regarding the cork life preservers. The manufacturer of the granulated cork blocks had inserted iron bars into the center of each cork block as a cost-cutting measure. The General Slocum was inspected and approved by the Steamboat Inspection Service just a month prior on May 5, 1904, and the Commission's report includes a lengthy description of items that should have been inspected, tested, and reported. Either these were not checked at all, or any defects found were ignored. Had the life preservers, fire hoses, water pumps, lifeboats, and other items been thoroughly and accurately checked, over 1,000 lives could have been saved. In a final stinging rebuke of captain and crew, the report declares, "The evidence before the commission establishes the fact that the master made no attempt whatsoever to fight the fire, to examine its condition, or to control, assure, direct, or aid the passengers in any way whatever. An essential fact of negligence is the utter failure of the master to fight the fire or aid the passengers. In a less degree, the pilots, in the same manner, after beaching the boat, and while there were still many passengers on board, failed in their duty to assist and rescue the said passengers. Very little assistance was given or control exercised by any of the officers or crew on behalf of the passengers." The commissioners also included a strong reprimand of the ship's owners, Knickerbocker Steamship Company, writing, "While it is true that it is the business of the Steamboat Inspection Service to see that proper safety appliances as required by law are provided, this by no means relieves the owner from a similar legal and moral obligation, nor from the liability for the maintenance of proper crew discipline. The commission is of the opinion that the owners of the General Slocum are censurable in a high degree for the inadequate and improper conditions prevailing on board this vessel, and that, whatever may be their technical legal liability, they and their executive agents share largely in the moral responsibility for the awful results of this disaster." After reading the commission's report, President Theodore Roosevelt wrote a letter to the Secretary of Commerce and Labor. Dated October 12, 1904, Roosevelt writes, "The Department of Justice has secured the indictment of the manager and three employees of the Nonpareil Cork Works of Camden, New Jersey, for putting upon the market compressed cork blocks for use in making life preservers, each of which contained in its center a piece of bar iron weighing several ounces. This last offense was of so heinous a character that it is difficult to comment upon it with proper self-restraint." During testimony, President of the Knickerbocker Steamship Company, Frank Barnaby, was questioned about suspicious receipts for repairs to the General Slocum. The following is a transcript. "You know of your own knowledge that these bills are for Slocum apparatus?" Barnaby: "I do." "You are sure all these were for the General Slocum?" Barnaby: "Yes." "If this is the case, how is it I find in some of these bills the name Grand Republic, another company steamboat, scratched out or taken out with acid and the name Slocum inserted?" Barnaby: I suppose some bookkeeper must have done that. A total of 8 men were indicted. Captain von Schaik, 2 inspectors of the Steamship Inspection Service, and high-ranking members of Knickerbocker Steamship Company. But only von Schaik went to trial. Charged with criminal negligence for failing to maintain proper fire drills and fire extinguishers, and misconduct, von Schaik was found guilty on both charges. He was 70 years old when he was sentenced to 10 years at Sing Sing Prison in New York. His wife, Grace, worked tirelessly to collect 200,000 signatures to petition for President Roosevelt to pardon the captain. But Roosevelt, 2 times, refused the request to pardon von Schaik. After serving 3.5 years in prison, von Schaik sat before the parole board, but this time under the administration of a new president, William Howard Taft. Captain von Schaik was granted his release in 1911. On December 19, 1912, President Taft pardoned von Schaik. The captain lived out the rest of his days on a farm with his wife in Fulton County, New York, and died in 1927 at age 90. Captain von Schaik was the only person convicted for the General Slocum disaster. Neither Frank Barnaby nor other executives of the Knickerbocker Steamship Company were convicted. Only a small fine was levied against the company. Steamship Inspector Henry Lundberg, who approved the condition of the General Slocum, was fired by President Roosevelt, but was not convicted of any crimes. The management of Nonpareil Corkworks were indicted for their gross negligence, but none were convicted.
Just before Halloween in 1985, a pipe bomb exploded in an office building in downtown Salt Lake City, killing a man and leaving the entire city on edge. As the smoke cleared and investigators began the search for answers, it became terrifyingly clear that this was just the beginning. Suddenly, looking for the culprit became a race against time. Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of the new true crime history podcast, American Criminal. We take you inside the minds of some of our most notorious felons and outlaws, exploring the dark side to the American dream. In our latest season, the desperate hunt for a killer leads the authorities through the complicated world of historic document collectors, and eventually, right to the door of the Mormon Church. Listen to American Criminal, The Salt Lake City Bombings, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get early ad-free access to the entire season first, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe at intohistory.com.
The hull of the General Slocum was salvaged and miraculously reformed into the barge Maryland. It sank in 1909 in the South River in New Jersey. It again was recovered and put into service for a short time. It sank, for the last time, off the coast of Atlantic City, New Jersey, due to leaks in its hull. The tragedy of the General Slocum fire was the largest loss of life in a single day in the history of New York City, until the World Trade Center attack on September 11, 2001. As a direct result, new regulations and higher standards were enacted, including fireproof metal bulkheads, steam pipes to extend from the boiler into the cargo areas to act as a sprinkler system, more effective life jackets, and a requirement to have one life jacket for each passenger and crew member, easily accessible lifeboats, and improved fire hoses with a 100-pound pressure capacity. A memorial to the victims of the General Slocum shipwreck was erected in 1906 in Tompkins Square Park in New York City. The Tennessee Marble Obelisk Fountain was funded by the Sympathy Society of German Ladies. Engraved into the marble are these words: "They are Earth's purest children, young and fair." Adela Liebenau Weatherspoon was the youngest survivor of the General Slocum fire, just 7 months old at the time. Her mother Anna also survived, but her sisters Helen and Anna, as well as 2 cousins and 2 aunts, all perished. Adela was the last living survivor of the disaster, and she died in 2004 at age 100. Catherine Kassebaum, whose words you heard at the top of this episode, was reunited with her daughter Annette following the disaster. Sadly, 9 other members of her family, including 2 of her daughters and 4 of her grandchildren, perished in the East River. That is going to do it for Flames of Sorrow, the General Slocum Tragedy. Thank you so much for listening. Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is written, edited, and produced by me, Rich Napolitano. Special thank you to my wife, Dawn Napolitano, for voicing the words of Catherine Casabon. Please remember, you can listen to Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs and many other history podcasts ad-free by subscribing to Into History. Go to intohistory.com/shipwreckspod to subscribe. Or you can support the show with a one-time donation at buymeacoffee.com/shipwreckspod. You can find all episodes, images, transcripts, and merch at shipwrecksandseadogs.com. And you can follow the show at shipwreckspod on social media. Original theme music is by Sean Siegfried, and you can follow him on YouTube at Sean Secret or on the web at seansiegfried.com. Once again, thank you so much for listening. Please join me again next time. But until then, don't forget to wear your life jackets.